Hello and welcome to the Bitcoin with Jake show. Today I've got Danny Brewster with me. Danny, welcome.
Thank you.
No worries. Pleasure. No, it's great to have you on. So we love stories in this podcast, and we want to hear about yours. To kick things off, could you give us a little update or overview of who you are and the projects you're working on at the moment?
Okay. So I'm the CEO and co-founder of the AAO group of companies, recently relocated to the Isle of Man between Ireland and the UK. Moved the businesses here. We operate fastbitcoins.com and Freehold Capital as well. We are also in the process of launching another brand, but I don't really want to give too much away about that at the moment. My personal journey in Bitcoin started end of 2011, early 2012. It's probably one of the more complex stories in Bitcoin, to say the very least. So it's
brilliant. Well, that's what we're here for, Danny. Let's get into it. So we'll get into the companies that you're running, I think, a little later down the line. So let's go to 2011. And a bit of context, please. So where were you in the world? What were you up to at the time? And what was it about Bitcoin that was exciting or interesting when you came across it?
So when I discovered Bitcoin on some remote blog, I couldn't even point to exactly where it was. But it was either a blog or a forum. And I had my hand in pot, so I had to literally switch my mouse over. I just remember it very clearly, a time where I couldn't really work or do anything because I'd broken a couple of bones in my hand. So it was all in pot and just reading, just like sleuthing the internet. And previously I'd worked for HSBC and another bank in the UK, which was ultimately acquired by Santander. It was Abbey National. I was the youngest ever employee straight out of school.
God, that's a good name. I forgot. I used to have an Abbey National account. I think I was given some money by my godfather when I was born or something, and ended up with Santander. I couldn't find it. Had to go and get hold of them somehow. Sorry, I digress and jump in and talk about myself. We're trying to talk about you. It's such a long time since I heard that name. And sorry, so you were working in the banking space as a banker or some other kind of role?
It was in the retail side of the bank, so like the real low rungs of the bank, if you will, in the grand scheme of things, not like Nathan that you had on previously.
No, okay,
So, but I was 16, and college wouldn't take me. I wanted to go and do computing to then go on and do computer science, but I was a terrible teenager that didn't really do too well. Academically, I did well enough, but in the behavioral side of school, it just bored the life out of me, really disruptive and things like that. So huge regrets now as an adult, probably the impact that I had on others around me at the time when I was at school, but got there in the end, and then discovered Bitcoin, because I couldn't really work because my hand was in pot. Couldn't really type, one finger typing on my left hand, using the mouse like back to front. And then literally it was the ability to transact without a third party in the middle. I didn't get the scarcity and all of that immediately. Although I remember very early on when I worked for Abbey National. So it was Abbey National, then it became Abbey. They rebranded and then it got bought by Santander. And I sat there, I was looking at a £20 note and I promised to pay the bearer. And one of the older women in the branch turned around and said, "Yeah, that's a load of rubbish now." And that always stuck with me then. I had no real reason to question money before that, or like understand the gold standard and things like that. So it was just basically, for me, the ability to transact without having to use a third party in the middle, having dealt with people that had payments placed on hold and they was trying to just go about their daily life and all of that. So when I discovered Bitcoin, Silk Road was still a thing, and basically started going down the rabbit hole and downloaded Tor, had a look at Silk Road. Wow. Bought some cigarettes off Silk Road, had them delivered.
Probably some other bits and pieces, but we won't mention that.
What's that? Sorry.
I said probably some other bits and pieces, but
no. That's something that that's never really interested me throughout my life. Was the whole drug side. Not gonna lie, I smoked weed when I was about 16.
Yeah,
just didn't really sit until I was much older and went to Amsterdam.
Yeah,
but even still to this day, it doesn't really interest me beyond any of that. So, so just basically that real world. Censorship resistance was just mind-blowing. And then as you start embedding yourself into, it was almost a community back then. People would still say it's a community now, but I don't really feel it. There's too much sense of community outside of like local regions. Obviously in Australia, you have the Bush Bash and big meetups and things and conferences, but online, back in 2011, 2012, even Reddit, you could have some real good, deep technical conversations and learn and just absorb information. I'd still say Turdemeister was the, gave a talk, and there was a video, and it basically explained how Bitcoin could get to like 50K per coin. And it was just mind blowing when you actually sat and watched it and had it broken down in such a way. And that's when it all just started to click in relation to like being a store of value and being able to basically absorb these different markets and use cases into it.
It's so interesting because everyone has a unique journey to this thing. I mean, it's, no one story is the same. I'm only a few episodes into this podcast and I'm hoping to do, you know, many hundreds, and everyone's will be different. Even at, you know, episode 1,000, you would have spoken to just 1,000 people, and there's a lot more than that than are already using Bitcoin. And I do like Tur's stuff, like the specifically the Protestant Reformation link that he made so clearly with the article that I wrote, released by Adamant Research, and talking about the importance of the printing press and, you know, the oppressive regime that the Catholic Church was at the time, and how, you know, religion and state were married together. And it was just, it was egregious. And there was then this huge release of energy, essentially, and a whole change in the way history was written, in a sense, and new nations appeared and rose, and different types of entrepreneurship happened. And it's extraordinary. I've never in so many ways had, like, history's always been interesting, but I haven't had the right context to really take a passionate interest in it, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And Bitcoin changes that with so much. And I'm sure you'll have lots of similar examples.
Yeah. Although that video that I saw of Tur giving the talk or presentation was nowhere near as articulate as that article that was
then
released.
Became. Yeah, interesting. Yeah.
I have a little bit of history with Tur, but I have nothing but like admiration and respect for somebody that saw it and got it and understood it. But he was looking at Bitcoin through perhaps a different lens to a lot of people at that time. And that is the one thing that sticks in my mind that was like flicking a switch for the value of Bitcoin. And then there was also the added benefit of like the run up to, I think it was like $14.
And
then it crashed back down to like less than a dollar. And that also kind of gave me like my first cycle, if you will, of earning the crash stripes. But it was like, damn, it really can go up.
Danny. Yeah. And so basically a decade has gone by since this particular period.
Here we are
in 2022. I'm sure so much has happened since then. Could you give us a rough recap on, you know, what happened after that point? So, you know, you're on a niche website, your hand's broken, you're sitting around doing fuck all, and suddenly you read about Bitcoin, and then you come across Tur's video, and it's compelling. Like,
yeah,
what was the ecosystem like at the time? I mean, today there's so many educators out there. You know, it's just different ball game. So, could you give some context to that?
So there was, it's like chalk and cheese. It's like two different worlds. And actually, when I was sat on a bunch of cash in the bank following an inheritance around that time, and I remember just buying on an exchange in the UK that was called Intersango. It was run by Amir Taki, and it was run from like an office squat in London. They had faster payments, so easy transfer and buy some Bitcoin, withdraw it to my Bitcoin wallet. Running my own full node, as everybody did then, on my laptop, and just taking about 7 days to sync, because Bitcoin D wasn't the best back then, at syncing and doing the initial block download, withdrawing those funds, having them custody, and it's like, oh wow. And then started finding other places where people were doing peer-to-peer trades, so just basically brokering, selling Bitcoin on these forums and things like that for a premium, and just rebuying from Intersango at market rate using faster payments. Just basically trading that way and just arbitraging between the peer-to-peer aspect and the exchange. But then in the middle of 2012, I got a phone call from my daughter's mother. We'd separated, and she'd married somebody in the RAF, and she said, we're getting posted to Cyprus. So there's two British forces bases in Cyprus. The RAF is based at Akrotiri. So after the initial, you're not taking my daughter shock, I rang her back and said, yeah, I'll move over so we can maintain the relationship. It's an opportunity for her. So they moved over. A couple of weeks later, I sold everything up and moved over myself with my partner at the time. And we basically just continued trading Bitcoin, OTC, for a few months. And then the bank bail-in happened whilst I was there. And then just sitting around with people that I'd met, there was people that had literally just sold a house to downsize. They had a bunch of cash in the bank to retire, haircut. So they had to go back to work and things. It was insane.
Am I right in thinking that people had cash in the bank in Cyprus, and anything over maybe $500,000 or something, the government just...
No, 100,000 euros.
100,000 euros. Yeah, just talk us through 50%. That, because it was a wonderful example in how egregious government can be in the world of finance, and is, if anything, just a brilliant use case for Bitcoin. So what happened exactly at that time?
Okay, so what was actually happening was people were borrowing from the Cypriot banks a low interest rate, investing that money in Greek bonds, and then when Greece started defaulting on their debt, the payments stopped. So did the payments in the Cypriot banks to repay the loans that people had taken out. So basically just leveraging the interest rate differences between borrowing in Cyprus and investing that capital in Greece. And then when Cyprus needed to be bailed out by the IMF and the Troika and everything, the ECB, they said, you're going to have to recapitalize the banks with depositors' funds. So the original proposal was 8% of everything over 1,000 euros would be taken from depositors' accounts. Wow. A lot of people went crazy. These are meant to be insured. So you was meant to have the 100,000 or 85,000 euro insurance. That was kind of just out of the window. And then the president basically said, they'll burn everything down if we actually do this to people. So it would have impacted everybody. So then they took the angle of, we'll just will haircut 50% of everything over 100,000 euros in people's accounts. So if you've got payroll and you've got a 200,000 euro payroll bill, so you've got 200,000 euros in cash in your account ready to run payroll on a Friday, you suddenly have 50% less.
Wow.
So, yeah, 50,000 less. So it was a lot of businesses and a lot of people that was like mid-house sale, where they had large amounts of money or cash in the bank. The whole thing, they tried to spin it as an angle of, we're going to tax the Russian money that sat in the Cypriot banks.
Yeah, of course.
But all of the Russian money, and also, funnily enough, the politicians and their families' money all moved to Malta in the weeks before this.
Wow. So,
it kind of sucked. And they was given
just madness, isn't it? When you hear
they was given like worthless shares in the banks that were non-profitable and needed this to happen. So, and at the time, being a Bitcoiner, I was like Bitcoin user, like not affected. Just sitting down and talking to some people, and just the feelings of like people that had actually lost money in this process, how devastating that was for them. I was like, at the time, 2013, like, we've got just a thing for this that can stop this. Like, nobody can take this from you if you hold it right, which was just far too early and stupid. But that kind of triggered the idea that maybe there's a business in here to build, to provide access to this technology to everybody in Cyprus. I started about building that business.
Okay. Yeah. And inevitably, entrepreneurship is about being agile and seeing opportunities. You know, what problem have you seen that if you solve it, someone will pay you? And this is a brilliant use case. So what business came out of that? And one question that I did have in mind. So how old were you roughly at the time, Danny?
2013. simple maths. It's an early start. What was I? 27.
Okay. Wow. So you were no, but point being is you were a young man, right? So amazing to hear. Yeah. So you'd mentioned a daughter.
I had my daughter at 21.
Wow, did you really? Bloody hell, mate. Good effort. And of course, like, no one can predict what life is gonna do. And we just have our best crack, right? And if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. But then managing the fallout of that, you know, what a tough time that must have been. And to pick yourself up and get across to Cyprus, that would have been immensely challenging, I'm sure. And to
I lost my mother in between that as well. Oh, yeah, I lost my mother at 23 to motor neuron disease, which is ALS.
Wow. I'm so sorry to hear that, Danny.
It's part of life. It's the hard part. That and like losing loved ones and pets.
Pets get you more than you think. No, actually, well, I'll share too. My father was 48 when he died, and I was just 20 years old. And that's in some ways the trigger that's got me here today to be talking about Bitcoin in the way that I am. Because I also, you mentioned inheriting money. I had inherited some money after a house sale, and I've been looking for ways of protecting that for 10 years. And I haven't truly discovered a tool to do it until I really got down the Bitcoin rabbit hole. And that's really what this is all about, is sharing that in some senses. But to focus back on yourself, the use case that Cyprus proved in a sense was like, you know, there's that article in the Genesis block of Bitcoin, which is, you know, Chancellor bailout, you know, 2009 or whatever it was. And whoever the creator... Chance on the brink. Whoever the creator, he, she, they are of this insane technology, it's very clear why they built it in that sense, because they were unhappy with the way that the financial system was functioning and favoring a select few at the top. Even that story of the Cypriot politicians and all of the high net wealth Russians chipping over to Malta, typical, right? And even today, so, you know, officials in the White House saying there's going to be outrageously high inflation. Well, tell us what it is. Like, those numbers are coming out, you know, 12 hours from now, whatever they might be. They've had a 24-hour head start, right? Like, how bad can it
just
be?
Just look at what Pelosi's husband's doing.
Yeah, whatever she or he is up to, like $200 million she's worth or whatever. It's just crazy. It probably is more than that, frankly. I don't know. I'm sure I read it was 200 mil, but I could be wrong. So the point is the history is littered with examples of the financial system being rigged to benefit the few that control it versus the individual. And Cyprus was just another one of those examples. So, yeah, cool. Okay, so you were in Cyprus. You saw this opportunity. How do I build a business to make Bitcoin more accessible to people? Great starting point. So where did you go from there?
So just basically wanted to address like the key areas that really needed addressing. And that was, how do I get it? How do I store it? And how do I use it? So I had the idea, and multisig was very like really nascent. One funny example is during the conference in Amsterdam in 2013, basically during Vitalik's presentation, this wasn't his quantum mining investment opportunity that Bitcoin Erolog wrote a blog about. This was actually a genuine presentation on how to use multisig using the Bitcoin CLI on the command line to craft a multi-signature transaction. So this was before Casa existed and those types of like custodial services. And the idea was to basically give the retail customer by default a multisig wallet that was hosted by us, but they controlled one of the keys, and we had a third key with a third party as a backstop. So that was how to store it. We were building or how to buy it. So I thought a lot of people have the fear of change. So to basically give them a way in which that they were used to interacting with a financial institution in Cyprus, which was still like a branch network where you could go, engage face to face, have conversations and learn. A big component about it was actually learning like what Bitcoin was. So the idea was to have these physical branches where people could go deposit their money in exchange for Bitcoin, open up their wallets and receive their Bitcoin that they could self-custody in a collaborative multisig wallet. So that was one of the ideas, or two of them, I should say, which would have both been world first. And then to use Bitcoin, this was before Lightning Network was even a thing, or even before the block size wars with Bcash and everything about spending money and spending Bitcoin. So we the idea was the B network. So we had Neo and B, which is now infamous amongst some older people that have been around a while. And basically the B network was a physical card with an EMV chip that would have acted as like a signing device talking to our API. So a replacement for Visa or MasterCard that we could use at the point of sale to perform Bitcoin transactions. They could also produce like QR codes for point of sale use of Bitcoin around Cyprus. We were 2 weeks away from having McDonald's have these POS devices so you could buy a McDonald's. It's taken, let's say, nearly a decade further along for this to actually now be a thing in like El Salvador on Lightning.
Longest 2 weeks ever.
Sorry?
Longest 2 weeks ever.
Yeah. there was like one family that owned the rights to the franchise of McDonald's in Cyprus. And we had three of the four key decision makers already on board with Bitcoin, you couldn't use credit or debit cards at McDonald's in Cyprus because JCC, the card payment acquirer for the island, like they had a monopoly on the market, and like even McDonald's didn't get a special deal. So everybody just got like taken advantage of with the fees. If you did online commerce, you was instantly high risk. So you had like 180 day settlements and like 3 to 7% payments, regardless of what you was doing online, if it was through them. So you couldn't buy a Big Mac using a Visa or MasterCard at that time in Cyprus. So we was saying, oh, you can accept Bitcoin payments at the point of sale, 0%, it's instant. Like we could do zero conf transactions and things. But it ultimately exploded. Luckily the software wasn't actually ready for customers to start coming in and opening the wallets. The software was remarkable now when I look back, because there's so many like business models that have come from that. Even at the time, like Bitcoin ATMs were a really, really new thing. Like Lamassu, like Bitcoin ATM, there was very few of them in the world. So having like the physical aspect of somewhere to go and buy a Bitcoin, I think places like individual places popped up around those times, like the Bitcoin Embassy in Montreal from like Francis, things like that were about, but not on a grand scale for like multiple town coverage or multiple cities and things like that under a single brand. And it really, like now I say you've got like Casa and BitGo and things like that that use multi-sig. But yeah, it was way, way too early.
Mm. And it's funny, a critique you often hear for ideas or startups specifically is they were just too early. And that could be in reference to any number of different technologies or fashion trends that have hit the market over the last 10 years. The fun thing with Bitcoin is when you really get close to it, you understand this thing's not going away ever, right? It's going to eventually supersede all, you know, financial markets in terms of how the world potentially functions as a base layer, in my opinion. But that's going to take some time. And the difference being, though, is it's not just like a fashion trend. It's going to be around. So if 2013 wasn't the right time for some of those business models, that doesn't mean that they don't then apply today. So all the hard work that you were doing as an entrepreneur then to ideate out, like, how would this work? Is this a big enough problem? What do customers really want? And I do love the recognition you put in there to physical exchanges, like the idea of just going into a bank and still transacting how you previously would have done, just with a new technology, so a user hardly even knows the difference, really. There's probably plenty of other ideas that you've had over the years that also didn't perhaps time the market effectively. So moving on from that stage a bit then, Danny, so what did you manage to get a business off the ground, get some revenues going, or
no,
it just was like an early doors window as to the opportunities that might lie later?
No, so the biggest mistake, or second biggest mistake I made, was I raised capital for it from within the Bitcoin space at the time. This was at a time when there were places like Bitfunder, Havelock, and all of that. So basically almost like securities exchanges, like purely just Bitcoin only. Eventually, like that whole component of the marketplace got closed down. But what happened was essentially there was like an internal revolt led by one person within the team. And I came over to the UK for like 5 days. I had return tickets and stuff, but I received a threat towards my daughter from this person within the team.
Wow.
And then all hell broke loose. There was like news stories about me fleeing Cyprus. I'd absconded with people's money. And it just went absolutely crazy. All of the media was full of like pure speculation. There was like an arrest warrant issued for me in Cyprus. And then there was a news story that broke that they was going to issue a European arrest warrant for me, which they did. And I basically had to stay silent throughout it all, which just left room for like rampant speculation as to what had happened and things like that. In some respects, I didn't handle it the best way possible. But then in other respects, I didn't go to jail for crimes I didn't commit. And it basically went on for the best part of 2.5, nearly 3 years. It took them a year. As soon as the news stories came out, I literally went to the police station in the UK and said, look, I'm here. Apparently this story in the Daily Mail or the Mail Online says that I'm a wanted man. I'm here. How do we sort this out? They looked it up and made some phone calls and we've got nothing, but we know where you are. If anything comes through, we'll contact you. Then literally a year and a bit later, I get a knock on the door, midway, half-time of a pre-season friendly of Liverpool in the middle of the summer, enjoying the game, knock on the door and we've come to arrest you under this European arrest warrant. You'll be taken to the police station. You'll then be taken down to Westminster Magistrates in London, where they'll hear your extradition case. I was like, oh, great. But only at this point did I get to see what the accusations were against me that was contained within the European arrest warrant. And it was just, I just burst out laughing. They was hilariously funny. Because they were so convoluted. and there was literally, out of like 5 accusations, did I only ever receive something for one of them? And there was like, I think it was like 7 individuals that I'd done personal like OTC deals with Bitcoin. And some of the, like there was 2 or 3 of them where I was still holding the Bitcoin as per the agreement until NEO was open and they could become NEO customers and use the wallet that was going to provide through NEO. So basically as soon as everything crazy went happen, I contacted these people directly and said, look, if you provide me a wallet address, I'll send you them. So I organized all of that with the exception of one. It was a builder. And he didn't have the technical competency to take delivery. So I said, what I'll do is I'll just buy them back from you. I'll organize the funds to be paid into your account for the original deal. Like the Bitcoin price had dropped at this point. I lost out on the deal. But fortunately for me, I had 2 receipts of the deposits to his bank account. Mm. But within the warrant, the only thing where I actually received anything was around his coins. So he'd been told to make the complaint that I'd not delivered the coins. But then the Cypriot police, funny enough, wasn't aware of that deposit being made, despite my legal team telling them and the Crown Prosecution Service in the UK, that we had the receipts to nullify this and the proof. To nullify that accusation. And it was the only thing, the only accusation in the warrant that gave it any weight was theft, which I clearly didn't do. everything else was geared around contracts and wording in contracts that I had apparently written. But luckily for me, I've got a lot of emails. I don't really delete them very often. And the big one, was basically a contract named a company within the text of the agreement. And it had LTD on the end, so a limited company as if it was incorporated. But at the time of the contract, that company actually hadn't been incorporated. So they said to me that I was misrepresenting the deal by stating an incorporated company. So that is fraud. That is uttering a false document and some other fraud-related accusations. But this is the reason why I laughed so hard, was because I didn't actually write that contract. And I remembered the contract because I received it from the person that made the accusation against me. And I literally sent it back with comments on those parts, basically saying, this isn't correct because this isn't incorporated yet. But they tried to represent it as me trying to deceive somebody. And I was just like, this is what I'm dealing with. Like, this has destroyed my reputation. This has destroyed, like, taken a year of my life with my daughter because she was still in Cyprus throughout. I couldn't go back. I couldn't see her for a year. The impact and everything was just around these garbage accusations. And then all of a sudden, I'd been for a walk, checked my phone when I got back to the car, and I've got an email from my barrister in the UK that said it's all been dropped.
Wow.
Cyprus have requested for the warrant to be cancelled. Yeah, Cyprus, like, and they was willing to extradite me. It was going through the court process. The CPS in the UK didn't care about any of the illegitimacy or the falseness of the claims. All they cared about was, is this warrant valid? And if I go to Cyprus, am I going to be offered a fair trial, basically, or is the process going to be fair? And all the way throughout, they said, if you come to Cyprus, we're going to remand you in prison whilst we carry out our investigation. And I was like, I'm not having that. I've not actually done anything wrong. And then, like I say, they literally just dropped it out of nowhere. And then I get an email basically saying, we've dropped it. We would like to send some officers over from the Economics Crimes Unit to interview you at the Cypriot Embassy in London at your convenience, so we can just close everything off. But you can't have a lawyer present. One of two things. One, now if they ever try to extradite me again, I've got proof that they won't give me my legal rights in Cyprus because they're willing to do that. So I agreed, went down, had a 5-hour interview, which I recorded on my phone, which was just sat on the desk. So I've still got that recording. And by the end of the interview, I asked them, so what would you do if you was me? They said, see these people in court, if they've cost you, which was essentially millions of dollars in value and my reputation and everything. So it was, a challenging time.
Wow.
I made a whole bunch of mistakes. Obviously, I hired somebody into the team. I've got emails from other team members, and there's people that was working for Neo in Cyprus that work for me today or work with me today. Some of the biggest backers of Neo met them in person. They came over and they backed the new company that we've built. So I forever grateful to them for actually like showing that faith in me to see beyond the headlines and hopefully like repay them going forward. But that's why we're now called like AAO, which is Against All Odds. We're still standing, still fighting and still building.
I love that. So many questions, Danny. What a challenging time that must have been. You mentioned towards the end there that you made a bunch of mistakes. What do you think you've learned from those mistakes? So I always love this concept of, as we grow older, how old was I then? You know, trying to remember back. But I feel comfortable at night when I go to bed if I think I'm, I don't want to use the word improving, but growing is probably a better word. You made a bunch of mistakes. What did you learn from those mistakes going forwards? And how did you incorporate those into your future businesses or relationships?
So at the time that the company collapsed, I think was paying around about 120,000 euros a month for software developers. Like, so there was a point in time during, like, at one point I had a curfew, so I was electronically tagged, so I couldn't leave the house and my bail conditions and things. And I just thought to myself, where have I expended the most amount of resources in the last 10 years of my life? And it was between lawyers and software developers. So I really considered doing a qualifying law degree. The law does kind of interest me. I do have a bit of a grasp, but obviously not to the level of a lawyer that charge far too much money because they can. The other one was actually building something. I used to hack bits and pieces together. I remember having like a premium rate telephone number that people at school could message and receive the like the ringtones on the Nokia 3210s. I hacked that together using my modem and my desktop PC and stuff when I was like 13, 14. Mm-hmm. Things like that. So I'd always had that interest. And then, so I got back into just writing some code, developing little projects and just re-finding that love and passion for writing code and creating things myself. So, and then basically started building out what would become Fast Bitcoins. We had a POS device, so we could go after the Bitcoin ATM business model. And actually I've got one right here.
Awesome.
So just basically started writing code and built a minimum viable product myself. So I would say having that and the technical competency to be able to do that and the understanding of Bitcoin and working with Bitcoin, like hacking stuff together and prototyping stuff to show what I mean, and just doing it myself. I lost a lot of trust in people, and there's like Obi from CoinFloor. I sat down and spoke to him for hours at a conference, like the second conference I've been to since everything went crazy. Not about personal safety and stuff, but you don't want to go somewhere and just be like shouted out of the room because everybody thinks you're a scammer or what have you. But I even if their hate is misplaced and stuff, I don't get any of that now, or if I do, it's very, very little. But the I sat down with Obi and he was like, if you can actually build this out and launch it, you're gonna have to start trusting people. I was like, damn, yeah. So that's when I reached out to two of the people, my co-founders, that had backed Neo and said, look, this is the idea. What do you think?
And sorry, Danny, just briefly. So Neo, was that the brand name of the previous company that you tried to set up?
Yeah. Neo, okay, and B.
Clear. All right. Yeah. And so inevitably, I like the phrase, make failure your friend. I've also had some failed startup projects and fuck, it hurts. It hurts so much.
Make failure, not an explosion, but make failure your friend. Yeah. Don't be afraid of failure.
It's one of those things. It's really easy to say, but to do is immensely hard. Like, it's emotional and you lose money and you lose some relationships and you come under immense strain and stress and, oh fuck, it's intense. But out of that comes, you know, a bit of fight, you know, against all odds. What a great name for a company. I love it. And so, okay, so with Obi, because I was a CoinFloor customer before they rolled into Coin Corner and had followed a bit of his stuff online. I don't know him myself, but he was an inspirational character at the time, was he, and helped you really think about where to go forwards? Or
I like to say it's give and take with me and Obi.
Okay.
So it took me 2 years, but he got to being Bitcoin only eventually. I did get the opportunity last November at a conference to thank him to his face on stage for basically just pointing the obvious out, but nobody else had been on that journey or what have you to be able to do that, especially like in this industry. Mm-hmm. So I was coming off, so my record was coming off the back of being like the fourth biggest villain in Bitcoin in 2014. Just ahead of Warren Buffett and just below Mark Parlers in the villains list, to actually trying to build something. And I to this day, I could have just put somebody else up front and had a back seat and nobody would have known anything. But I think appreciating the journey, I should do more of. If I'm going through due diligence of anything for anything financial or anything, or investors for the business or anything, I literally have a document that's called imnotacriminal.pdf that is basically a breakdown from the head of police in Cyprus, basically saying I was never charged with a crime, which I haven't been. I'm completely
wow, so it's all noise.
Clear criminal, yeah. But it's just all of the media articles and things. Google have started removing a lot of them. But just from like a due diligence perspective, it's like, so this is who I am, and this is a component of like the background, but this explains it. So yeah, it's like a constant reminder that you should learn the lessons. And yeah, I don't think I could ever survive if this one exploded. In another business,
but then that equally, you know, that's called having skin in the game.
Oh yeah,
you know, like that's however you want to read into that particular phrase. But some of the most amazing entrepreneurial stories come from moments of extraordinary adversity. And the simple statistic is the amount of migrants in the States that set up unicorn businesses, you know, $1 billion valuations. They're all run by people that emigrated to the country. Why is that? Perhaps certain characteristics of trying to prove yourself, or not having much to start with, or, you know, bringing work ethic from different parts of the world to the States. I don't know specifically. That's a whole nother kind of discussion entirely. But I don't want to dwell on this story per se, because it's part of your journey, but it's also not the only part. I do have one last question though. If we were to be conspiratorial for a second, what do you think the most critical driver was behind the people making these accusations? Like, why did they do what they did? Because if you weren't,
I received an offer to sign over everything we'd created to them in exchange for all of the legal stuff to disappear. Make of that what you will.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. Love it. So, okay. No, yeah. That's a nice way to close it off. I like it.
But okay, I would say just to touch briefly on the environment. So look, like reflection, that I do feel that the whole business would have been doomed in the long term. Because one shining example of this is after the bank bail-ins and the bank runs, where everybody was trying to just withdraw what they could, there was capital controls. One of the banks was put up for auction. This bank was owned by the church. It was a Hellenic bank. And the church wanted to buy it back, but they didn't have the cash to buy it. So what they did on a weekend ahead of the auction was they issued a bond in this saint's name. And people that had been pulling money out of the very bank that had screwed them over, that was owned by the church, they was queuing up around the block to give the money to the church for this bond so the church could buy the bank back.
You're kidding me. Wow.
And at only like really on reflection, I was like, damn, these people really probably aren't ready for the whole concept and idea. Yeah. Despite everything that had happened, because the church had come knocking and asking with the handout, they was queued around the block to participate in this bond offering from the church, to give the money back to the system that had just taken it from them. And at that point, it's like a little bit of a realization that, yeah, maybe it would have been too early. The older generations have a lot of control over the younger generations within that society as well. So the younger generations that would perhaps be more predisposed to getting into Bitcoin don't actually exert that much control over their own lives.
Interesting. And that's like a characteristic of a part of the world, essentially. Like, that's perhaps what Cypriot life is like. Moving on, Danny, you mentioned that most of your costs were on lawyers and developers, and you had this toss up. It's like, okay, I could actually maybe go down the legal direction, or I could go back down the developer direction. And you chose the developer route. So did you go to a specific coding academy, or back to university, or just sat down and just taught yourself? Like, how did you get back into the nitty-gritty of software development?
Just sat down and taught myself. I would have said, following tutorials, learning the reason why. I'm naturally inquisitive. I'm ENTJ, if that makes much difference to many people. My Myers-Briggs personality type. So naturally inquisitive, want to know how things work, and like a bit of a commander, if you will. So it's like a natural fit. Plus, I also understood, not saying Peter Woolley or anything like that, but I also understand Bitcoin and how to use it and what it can be used for, what it can't be used for. I've seen plenty of lessons being handed out by Bitcoin itself over the years to see what works and what doesn't. And I just absolutely love getting into the nitty gritty and making things work and figuring out why they work in certain ways and how can we improve that. So yeah, just basically taught myself how to code by playing around with different projects and then ultimately trying to build a proof of concept, and then basically just extrapolating from there, and just literally wrote the front end, the back end, all of the compliance aspects, the physical POS device, the software that runs on that, the software that manages the devices so we can update them and stuff. Just basically built it myself, just through trial and error and iterating. One thing that I would say is I think I'm genetically predisposed to having a stupid work ethic. I'll struggle to find people that are willing to work longer and harder than me. I've literally slept on this floor behind me so many times already.
Why is that a stupid work ethic?
Because it like everything, it comes with trade-offs. Family, just...
See, okay, yeah. Sorry. I thought you were referring to like a...
health?
Like a... Yeah, no, family and health, obviously crucial. Absolutely crucial. Yeah. Don't get me wrong. No, I thought you were referring to like the work smart kind of phrase.
These like four-hour work week stuff, I don't know how anybody could ever build...
Tried to read that book a number of times and I've never been able to finish it. So that probably says it all.
Maybe there's some really smart, efficient people out there that can build in 5 hour days or what have you. That I'm just obviously not smart enough, so I just need to hit that nail with the brute force.
Danny, if I could step in for a moment, I actually don't know many people that would sit down, self-teach themselves to write code. Right, the front end, the back end, a physical hardware device of a technology company, right? That's basically exactly what that is. That is the MVP.
It does surprise a lot of people.
That's not a stupid person. So you shouldn't be so self-deprecating, my friend. It's an amazing piece of ingenuity. And that's what I love about humans. We're very, 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 I used the word at the start, like, what was it? Agile, in a sense. So like entrepreneurs, they see these opportunities and they make them happen out of nowhere, and it's such an interesting thing to witness happening. So let's dig back into that a bit. So what is the initial use case that Fast Bitcoins was looking to solve?
So during the 2017 bubble, I was seeing Bitcoin ATMs charging like upwards of 25-30% fees, and for me, Bitcoin ATMs was always kind of interesting because it allows people to get in without having to share all of their info or to engage with engage with a shady company that had no real reputation. It was being run from an office squat. The only reputation I knew was that of Amir Taki and the business Intersango. And I just used faster payments to send them money electronically. Could have easily screwed me over or what have you. And just having an option where people can get a little bit of Bitcoin, because to see how Bitcoin works, I think And when you first receive it or you first send a transaction, that for me is like a light bulb moment. And then obviously when the price does its thing, that can also be another light bulb moment for many people, to trigger that interest to know more about what it is that they actually buy and own. I think it's much more difficult in today's day and age because you've just got all of the shit coins that are just being constantly marketed. You sign up for one of the most common exchanges and the first thing that you're presented with is like 500 different things to buy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, and then you've got unit buyers to overcome and all of that.
Which is
and
huge. Just, I mean, why would you spend your 10 grand on not even one Bitcoin when you can buy like a million gazillion fucking God knows what?
Yeah. And this can go to 50,000 like Bitcoin can. And a big reason why I've never ever built anything on anything other than Bitcoin. So I mined some Litecoin really early on, but sold it at the $43 peak, thinking I was a genius. In 2014 or 2013, around November time, I think it was, sold the last of my Litecoin, and then I've just been completely Bitcoin only since then. Mm. Everything else is just noise and a distraction away from Bitcoin, and purely like gambling and speculative. So just for me, it was just solving this problem of getting a little bit of Bitcoin in people's hands. And then, so we did that by having this POS device. So merchant locations didn't have to have this big like floor space filling that cost like 10 grand. And then you had to manage the cash and they break down all the time and they're easy to steal. Or we've seen a lot more of places getting broken into to have the Bitcoin ATM smashed up to steal the cash from that's inside of it. Or if it's the dumbest criminals, they're trying to break in to steal the Bitcoin from inside of it. it was just to go after that market with the business model. So we could do like cash transactions at like 4-5%. At the time we didn't have to KYC every customer because there was low amounts and it didn't fall within like there was no fifth money laundering directive, and we was also like the world's first company to allow delivery on the Lightning Network, so people could go into a store with £10 or 10 euros and buy that amount of Bitcoin and have it and receive it on the Lightning Network in 2019. Like wow. November 2018, I think we beat a launch, and then January or February 2019, we
had post. 2018 is when you first launched your Fast Bitcoin's point of sale unit.
Yeah.
Okay, great, cool.
And then, we had Lightning integrated into it then. And at that point, you could also do Lightning payments at the point of sale mm-hmm. at the device.
To walk through for the less Bitcoin educated that might be listening, I walk into a store, I've got my mobile phone, I want to buy some Bitcoin. There's a Fast Bitcoins unit in, this might be like a news agent's or a supermarket or a petrol station or whatever. What happens next?
So at that time, you would just ask for £10 Fast Bitcoins voucher. The device would print out the voucher. You could then go to the fastbitcoins.com website and redeem that voucher, and you'd put in your delivery information for your wallet or for your Lightning channel, or you get to provide a Lightning invoice, and we'd just deliver across either the Lightning network or on chain.
Okay, great. Awesome.
Simple.
Really simple. And okay, and so that was 2018. So talk to me a bit about how that's grown over time. So like all entrepreneurial projects, it's really interesting to see what kind of traction you actually get when you put something out there. So was it immediately obvious that this was going to be an interesting business model, or did you have to iterate a bit from there?
We had to iterate a bit from there. So my original idea was to basically make it as low barrier of entry, because we had a business to business component, which was onboarding merchants to offer this.
Yeah.
So we gave them credit accounts, so they didn't have to put anything up front, things like that. So we'd just invoice them after like every 2 or 3 days, we'd send them an invoice and get settled. So that introduced like a credit risk exposure for us, which didn't get abused much at all. But there was a few, which was really annoying. But that is what it is. It was part of the risk that we took with that. And then we thought, how do we expand upon that? So we registered a subsidiary in Australia. We got to market in Canada as well, where one of my co-founders was at the time. And we then employed somebody to basically go door to or business to business to onboard these merchants. So we grew the merchant network to a couple of hundred locations dotted across Europe and the UK and Canada. And then in Australia, we took the decision that we would offer like online payment solutions, so like bank transfers through like Poly payments and things, and recently added direct debit, so people can dollar cost average using direct debit in Australia. But then COVID happened, and when we was planning the business, didn't foresee every retail location pretty much across the world being closed. And at the same time, the fifth money laundering directive came into effect. So we took the decision to stop all sales, and we rebuilt our entire front end and back end in its entirety, which is what I did, I should say. And we had to introduce customer accounts. We had to start doing KYC as per the EU's fifth money laundering directive. And we had to have a compliance function and all of that to become a more modern business that can stand up on its own going forward. Unfortunately, individuals can get away with it a lot more. But if you want a big business that's going to scale and help create a billion Bitcoiners, they've got bigger gangs with guns that can come and throw you in jail if you don't follow their rules. So we had to build all of that. And we relaunched with additional payment mechanisms. We have a deal with like FlexiPins. We're adding card payments, and we're just adding additional payment mechanisms into Fast Bitcoins going forward. So we can truly become like the world's local Bitcoin company. We're launching a prepaid debit card around the world as well. So people are about to top up their prepaid card using the Lightning Network, and they can spend that anywhere where debit and credit cards are accepted, either online or in person. About to use it with like Apple Pay or Google Pay and things. Just offering more of a wider selection of financial services to Bitcoiners around the world. And we want to basically become the company that when you say, when somebody asks you, where can I buy Bitcoin from? You can confidently say Fast Bitcoins, and we can pretty much serve you wherever you are in the world. As long as it's not on the big blacklist of sanctioned countries, we should be able to provide you with some level of service. And anybody that comes to us should or be able to refer people to us in confidence that we're not going to sell their friends down the river into some shitcoin for some mad gains or gambling activities. So that's the evolution of the product.
You mentioned, and thank you for sharing, Danny, you mentioned a billion Bitcoiners. Just to focus in on that for a second. So that's the mission of the company, is it? Could you just flesh that out a bit?
Yeah, I think Bitcoin's our only opportunity, and the people within the business as well pretty much agree that Bitcoin is our only opportunity at separating money and state, and what that means potential-wise for society as a whole. The money isn't, and Bitcoin doesn't fix everything, regardless of what you read on Twitter. It doesn't fix a lot of the human problems, but it can realign the incentives for certain aspects of society. And I think it would benefit hugely from having Bitcoin as ultimately like the world reserve currency, if you will, or as the I think we're probably going to head into a period of like deglobalization, or maybe even the introduction of another reserve currency alongside the US dollar. And then if you want some interoperability, Bitcoin is the obvious mechanism that sits in the middle, that would eventually win that market, if you will. But I think that's a lot of speculation, but that's where the opportunity is. And to do that, we need as many people on the planet as possible, either using Bitcoin or benefiting from Bitcoin directly through products and services, and to be able to use Bitcoin in a way that I feel it was designed, and that's in like a sovereign or as much of a self-sovereign way as possible.
And so some of my more privacy-focused Bitcoin friends would immediately come back to me and say, well, as an entrepreneur, you're looking to build a company, but you're enforcing KYC. Like, how is that, you know, enabling a sovereign kind of financial approach? Just as a bit of pushback, in a sense, I don't disagree with you in that I see a world in which people will be better off when they're able to use a neutral monetary network that can't be fucked with. You know, that's brilliant. Like, fix the money, fix the world. I absolutely buy that. But in some senses, one's having to bow down to, as you mentioned, bigger gangs with lots of guns. That is essentially, that is a government, right? There is something, where's the middle ground, basically? Like, as an entrepreneur, you've got to have a crack, and I see the use case, but equally, there's always other people going to snipe from the side. So just to kind of bring their viewpoint in for a bit, like, how do you justify the KYC stuff?
By proactively pushing back against it. So, you know, like, a lot of the noise from the sites comes from people that aren't actually operating, or if the one thing that I say to them is, go and build the no KYC solution that can, like, provide a pathway. I will be your biggest fan. I will be cheering you on. I would probably support you in that endeavor to do that. If I see it as a workable and scalable solution to the actual problem. So the thing for me as a business owner that has to do this is, like, I've got a family to support. Like, do I use Bitcoin as a Trojan horse and see it entering society and having an impact that way? Or do I go against the grain, drop my already well exposed activity in Bitcoin, develop a NIM and start trying to solve that problem? There are people that are trying to do that with things like BISC and HODL, and the people that build that and the people that operate it on it. So a big component that I say with regards to like the whole KYC solution is, and some people do trade in a way on, say, BISC, where they offer bank transfers. So if you're accepting a reversible electronic payment that somebody can later on call up the centralized entity, the bank, where they and you've already KYC'd yourself to accept that payment, or the payment provider, then you're going to have to, this happened like all the time on local Bitcoins. If you want to buy from peer to peer using your bank account, you've got to prove that you own the bank account that's sending the funds. So you've got to KYC to these individual people. So you've now shared your personal information, or a lot of the time shared your personal information with a whole bunch of individuals that you've chosen to do, and they've got no governance over what they do with that data. They could be absolutely sound and destroy it like within a week or what have you. Great. Or it could be being used maliciously. Now, that's not as a justification. That's just a real world example of where, because as soon as you start accepting payments from people that don't provide this information to you to prove it, they're going to literally call their bank, or it is going to be somebody using somebody else's bank account. And then you're going to end up on I think it's the SIPs list, which is basically like a fraud list. So every time you go to a financial service provider, your name gets pinged and they won't provide you with an account because you've got a history of fraud on your account with a previous, and you then have to go and spend 2 years trying to get yourself removed from this list. And you've created zero new Bitcoiners in the world. The only other exception is doing peer-to-peer in-person cash trades, which then also carries a physical risk. And one of my team members used to do that all of the time, literally went, met somebody in Liverpool, got reverse naked choke, had the 10K in cash stolen from them, lost the Bitcoin as well. So there is no golden solution. I think KYC is a lot of the time is like an overreach, but if you're accepting reversible payment mechanisms that when used negatively against you, they can steal from you, and two, they can literally kill any future prospect of you doing the same thing. So it's, there's no perfect solution. And if somebody's got it, go build it. I will cheer you on.
Yeah. What I like there is your thought process. I'm a strong believer in the free market and entrepreneurship. Someone will figure that out at some point, but let's be realistic. The playing field that's ahead of us today, pick your battles. If that's the main battle, then you're not going to get a billion people using Bitcoin. And if you don't get a billion people using Bitcoin, there's still going to be crazy money printing going on. There's still going to be crazy government overreach where they actually take your deposits off you, and these ridiculous concepts of bail-ins like we touched on in Cyprus. The list goes on. Like, Bitcoin improves on that by such a drastic degree. I guess the fear of these people that prefer to remain anonymous is totally rational. Like, one day we might get a knock on the door from someone who says, you bought Bitcoin in 2015 and we want to tax you for 40% of it because we just changed the rules, even though you haven't sold it, unrealized capital gains or something ludicrous like that. But one would like to think that A, that won't happen, but B, we can be agile enough to get around it, maybe move countries or whatever necessarily needs to happen.
This is like one of the biggest benefits of Bitcoin. So we as a company literally moved from the UK to the Isle of Man because of one thing. And it was the FCA, as part of their registration process to become a VASP in the UK, they require every company to provide every single wallet address linked to the company, be that hot or cold wallet. And for me, that's a massive overreach.
Yeah.
And it's very clear that there's a Chainalysis, the actual company Chainalysis, have essentially gotten into bed with the regulators directly to absorb this information,
and
to basically get the regulator to do their bidding. Because the way that their product works for on-chain analysis is they try and basically correlate data from their different exchanges and platforms and businesses and agencies that they work with to basically identify participants on the network. Now, we would never be a customer of theirs, so we would never be giving them that information directly. So all they can do is best guess, like, which are our wallets and things like that, to track users of our services across the network and things. But if they inject themselves into the regulators, they've just got to come to us and get the regulators to say, right, hand over all of your wallet ID, like they call it the wallet IDs, to us as part of your business plan in the most random place possible. And all they're basically doing is taking that information and feeding it into Chainalysis, and they'll go, this is from Fast Bitcoins. Here's all of their wallets. Are they legitimate? And Chainalysis will go, yeah, they're fine. Like, but thanks for the data.
Thanks for the information. Crazy.
Yeah.
It's
happening in Australia as well, and we're actively pushing back in Australia. So us as a company, not only do we, this is where my admiration comes in for people that are willing to like build Bitcoin only businesses. We could make so much more money by selling people shit, and we would be exposed to far more people in the market that are just looking to gamble and speculate, and the the crypto exchanges are actually pushing for a lot of this legislation because they want to be custodians. They want to hold as much of people's money as possible. So the Bitcoin only businesses are the ones that are pushing back for the right reasons, as opposed to like begging the regulators for more regulation to protect their market position by creating walled gardens and things. So I'm not on board with having to do KYC. Like I do have like reservations about the data that we collect and stuff, and that's why we place so much emphasis on how we store that and use that. But then on the other hand, it's like I know I can go to bed at night knowing that we push back when it's required. We might not always be successful. If we was ever like compelled to hand over like customer data to a regulator purely because, or to a tax department or any government entity based upon the fact that they just bought Bitcoin, I would leave that market. I would rather say somebody else can deal with that. That goes against who I am and what I stand for. I'm quite happy to do that, even if it's going to ultimately cost us a lot of early revenues, then so be it.
Great, Danny. And I think that's what so many ways people want to hear. You know, if you've really truly grasped what Bitcoin is and you've managed to avoid, or you, maybe you did go down the shitcoin hole, which, you know, frankly, many of us have, and I've still got some Ethereum. I still own it.
I'd have said no to this.
Yeah, sorry, mate. You know, I own a number of different investments, and you know, inevitably your attention gets drawn in different directions, and it's an important part of the process, understanding why Bitcoin's so important. And with people like yourself building companies in the space with that very clear and rational reasoning, then, you know, I think we have a very exciting future ahead. Danny, listen, quite a bit of time has flown by. I have a last section of questions I want to just rush through. So, well, not rush through, but just get through. You have a second business that you're looking to build out called Freehold Capital. Could you tell us a bit about that?
So my biggest gripe is people getting educated through sales materials. And this is what leads people into purely speculative positions. And having spent a lot of time speaking with IFAs, independent financial advisors, and also high net worth individuals and family offices. So we get contacted by investment firms, corporations all of the time. And they normally have like this one guy within the team that's pushing the idea of the company doing something in crypto. And they send over all of the what they know, what they think they know, where they're at. And we generally end up having a call with them, and it's purely educational. And we spend a good hour and a half just deconstructing what they think they know, and just clarifying and answering their questions. And it's education first, followed by we can provide some custodial services in a way that we incentivize. The more control we have over our clients' funds, the more we charge them, because we want them to take control of their own funds. And we're also building out a lot more in the custody suite using what's now possible with Taproot and TapScript and Schnorr signatures and signature aggregation. So we offer like a brokerage service to high net worth individuals, family offices, corporations, and as a way for IFAs to introduce their clients, because they can't, a lot of them can't give advice, or they just don't understand Bitcoin enough to be able to educate their client base on Bitcoin. So that's what Freehold. And for me, the name is just derived from Bitcoin being the best type of freehold capital or property that's available out there.
It's the best asset you can possibly own from a property rights perspective. I mean, come and get it off me. Like, how are you going to get it? It's such a, you know, you're one Bitcoiner of millions, and it's not going to happen, at least touch wood, you know. Let's not tempt fate.
Yeah. And if you see people, if you see the government or some people within society trying to attack other people, Bitcoin, you've got the capabilities of flight. So you can take that to where you're going to be treated better.
Yeah.
Like we have with the regulation and everything here.
And actually, that's a nice little segue into how's life in the Isle of Man? Have you enjoyed the move there?
Yeah. I'm probably the biggest salesman of the island for the government here, for like telling people to, specifically.
Now you explain why the regulators aren't all over you, because you're promoting the island so well.
I wish that was true, but I'm a little bit brash, or probably more outspoken than a lot of people that deal with the regulators, which I probably need to work on. But to be fair, it's great. In the UK, people started stealing people's dogs and things. Not that anybody would be stupid enough to try and steal my dogs, but the degradation of society over there, and the low crime rates here. The kids, our kids over here, they go out. It's beautiful. The air is fresh. All of the beef is grass fed. The milk tastes better. The cheese tastes better. Even the butter is like the best. It's a much more relaxed way of life. If I have five cars in front of me, I'm in heavy traffic. Annoys me. I'm already an islander. if I have to go all the way up to Ramsey, that's a long way. It's literally about 12, it's about 8 miles.
It's a blueprint that I think we'll see more and more of, Danny, frankly, where that phrase you used earlier of go where you're treated best. This is one of the first times, or arguably the first time in history, where an individual can own an asset that's something they can ultimately just store in their head. You know, if you actually remembered your seed phrase, you could go anywhere in the world, write it down, put it into a wallet, and you could fucking get your money back. It's just nuts, right? And that ability.
It's not getting your money back. It is your money.
Yes. Good definition change. So, and you still have the key to the vault, essentially.
Yeah.
Your money's not gone anywhere. You were just able to move somewhere physically, and it remained in the ether, you know, up there in the digital ecosystem. And I think that we'll see entrepreneurs like yourself doing this more and more, right? Going to places that they're treated best. And I love the way that you've talked about your life, in a sense, like the food you're eating, the air you're breathing. Like, these are actually incredibly fundamental parts of our lives that arguably for too long have gone forgotten, right? How do I feel? Oh, I'm fine. Going at like 400 miles an hour for 10, 15 years, fucking knackered is what you actually are. But you just don't feel anything because you're trying to keep up.
I'm still tired.
No, but sometimes the fiat world, you're sinking.
You're running against the water. You're trying to swim against the tide.
You understand that you own something called sound money, hard money. This is just revolutionary. So yeah, I'm looking forward to more stories from people like yourself that have, been on such amazing journeys and are really starting to enjoy parts of their life, I'm guessing. So Danny, listen, hour or so is like flown by, mate. It's sorry. Well, you had a comment there. Go on, jump in.
Yeah. I absolutely love my life. I have a love hate relationship with the business.
Fair enough.
But that's every startup, or every small business that's trying to make it. I've spoken to other like founders that have started businesses outside of the Bitcoin ecosystem. I try and do that as much as possible. There's just because it is such a roller coaster. Like your day can go from being brilliant because you've got this thing in place, or you've achieved this, and then you've got the next fire to put out. So it is one hell of a journey building companies. And the world that we live in with like social media and stuff, not everything is like to the right and up when it comes to building a startup, regardless of what people would make you think. Even the most successful companies have like real difficult times, and the founders have been feeling trapped because it's on you and your back's against the wall. But I wouldn't swap that for the world. And doing it from here, on the Isle of Man, like even just from being a normal Bitcoiner here, there's no capital gains tax, which is huge.
Wow.
And yeah, like the small government, I can literally walk across the street and tell them if I think they're being stupid with some legislation.
Wow.
The tax office, you can walk in and speak to somebody. The regulators, you can go and knock on the door and speak to somebody. It's the beauty of like, it's almost like a decentralized government, if you will. I think psychopaths would want power in the UK where you've got to try and keep 66 million people happy as opposed to 85,000 people in this small island. And it's why, like during COVID, they shut the borders, but everything on the inside stayed open. So you didn't have to wear masks. You didn't have social distancing for most of it. Yeah. Restaurants was open. Businesses was open. People could go to work. And it was like one of the big benefits and reasons why we moved over here was because of this type of environment.
I mean, you're absolutely right. And thank you for being so honest. Like most people would give you a bit of a sugar-coated, yeah, everything's fine, you know, but actually sometimes your business fucking drives you mad, right?
Yeah.
For some reason, the example that sprung to mind was actually Amazon in what must have been roughly 2000, post the dot-com crash, and they'd lost 80 or 90% of their value in the stock market. And there's an amazing Jeff Bezos open letter to his customers talking about, or his shareholders saying, like, basically, don't fucking worry. All of our metrics are improved. Like, we're selling more shit. We're building faster fucking supply chains. We're getting more and more people signed up to our platform. We're absolutely fine. Don't worry about it. Yet his company was 20% of the value it was a year before.
Yeah.
You think, oh, wow. Yeah.
I just finished listening to Amazon Unbounded, which is a lot of the, like the internal stories. And it did actually mention that about, I didn't panic, or to quote Jeff Bezos, was I didn't panic because all of the internal metrics were just up and to the right. They was just all heading in the right direction. But on the stock market and the public market aspect, it looked like a crisis, but he was...
Cool as a cucumber. Yeah. The funny thing as well, though, I spent years in the what I now consider to be the kind of conventional startup space, and we were looking at, you know, using artificial intelligence or blockchain or any other kind of modern software tool to basically automate the back end of insurance businesses, banks, shipping companies, you name it. And what in hindsight I realized we were being trained to do was recreate digital monopolies. And we were being put through technical programs or tech accelerators, whatever you want to call them, and build the next Google. You know, and Amazon was a company that was often mentioned. And, you know, Bitcoin teaches you in so many ways that like the world doesn't need to be completely unfair. And so rebuilding walled gardens like an Amazon, which is just become this absolute beast with all sorts of stories of, you know, employee misbehavior and driving costs and completely screwing the high street, you know, mom and pop shops and all this kind of stuff. That is the free market functioning in some ways. So you just got to let it go. But I'm interested to see like the philosophies of people like yourself and the companies that are going to build in 10 years from now. I'd be surprised if they look like that. If that makes any sense.
I think one of the biggest like fundamental shifts that we're doing is people might take it the wrong way, but we have previously seen issues with payment fraud where people are using ID documents that have been dumped from like a database that's been leaked or something. So they're using selfies and people's ID documents to basically create accounts for money mules and things.
Wow.
So we introduced video KYC. So I rebuilt our onboarding process, and we've built a team of individuals, like bilingual people that can speak to our customers in their local language. We have a video call. But what we've actually found through that process is that we can do a whole bunch more of education, safeguarding, and the big one of like people being misled into buying Bitcoin to send it to somebody that they've never met because they're being scammed. we can prevent so much of that happening as a business, that it's great. But we also now have just added a way for people to do it in like an automated fashion. So until deep fakes become a real big issue, we'll be offering that. So it'll be optional for customers to be able to speak to a real human. We might not have physical branches in all of the cities around the world and towns like the old banks and things, but we can have a human conversation with our customers. And to be fair, it is really, really well received by the customers that go through it, especially if they're just getting into the Bitcoin rabbit hole and they are just trying to acquire a little bit to use it. Our team will like go through that process with them. And it is making a fundamental difference to our customers' experience. So going away from like the digitalization of everything and running away from human interaction and human contact might not be for some people, but it's something that's missing for a lot of people, and we seem to be doing pretty well with it.
Enough, Danny. Just this week, a mate of mine, he's like, "Dude, what's this Bitcoin shit? You've lost it. You need to get off Twitter. It's not a real place." And he then starts telling me about the equities he's buying or whatever. Anyway, got a text: "Jake, inflation scared the shit out of me. How do I get into Bitcoin?" And you're like, "Great, okay. Some of what I was talking about must have made an impact." But I love the idea of sending them somewhere with more of like concierge service. And I think that's a great opportunity. And the feedback you're getting already, I'm sure, is very evident of the or good motivation to carry on. Danny, that has absolutely flown by, an hour and a half. Thank you so, so much for sharing all of that. It's been great to get to know you a bit better. I hope one day we get the chance to meet in person. And
I'm coming your way next year. I'm to Melbourne. I'm kayaking and paddle boarding around the Whitsundays.
Okay, cool. Yeah,
so it's like 100 kilometers. Yeah.
Wow. But
apparently, there's sea snakes and crocodiles that we've got to, and the sharks that we've got to avoid, according to Nath. But
well, if you're in Australia, then absolutely, I'll make the effort to come and find you.
Oh, I've got sure Nathan people to go well. And see.
Yeah, so. Sweet. Okay. Well, listen. Lastly, if people want to get in touch, what's the best way to do that?
At Fast Bitcoins, there's fastbitcoins.com. Freehold Cap on Twitter for the companies. I'm at BTC Danny. I literally removed all social media apps from my phone because they're just such a big time drain, and you end up arguing with some idiot on Twitter for 3 or 4 hours, and it's just such a waste of time. I deleted them, but I am on there occasionally when I find 5 minutes in the bathroom.
Awesome.
Have a scroll. Well,
thank you so much for your time, and good luck building your businesses.
No, thanks a lot, Jack, and good luck with this podcast. It's great so far.
Thank you very much.
Hopefully this maintains that.
No, mate, this is what I'm after is good real stories, and that's exactly what you gave. So thank you so much.
Great. Thanks a lot, Jake.